Good evening.
Good evening.
We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 again. And we'll be looking at verses 18 through 31. And so just very briefly to review what we've covered thus far. One of the things that we observed as we began to kind of look at an overview of the book was a characteristic that Paul brought out a number of times. Who can remember what that was? Okay, that's the other word for it. What was it, Tanya?
Pride.
Pride, but what was the word he used?
Puffed up.
Okay, so I can't remember the number. I think it's six times in the book. He either refers to them as puffed up, refers to their behavior as puffed up, or warns them about being puffed up. And that is six out of seven times that term, it's a specific Greek word, is found in the New Testament. So we at least postulated that the Lord must have brought that particular phrase to the forefront of his mind as he was considering what to write and as the Holy Spirit was leading him in what to write. And I think we find evidence of that attitude scattered throughout the book. So they had a real problem with pride. And we saw in the first chapter in verse 7, I believe, that Paul talked about, or he gave them somewhat of a commendation. He said, go to verse 6, even as the testimony of Christ was confirmed in you. So Paul didn't, he wasn't wavering on whether these folks were saved or not. He had confidence in that. But then he said, so that you come behind in no gift. So they had been blessed abundantly with spiritual gifts. And so as Paul looked at them and he could recognize that, you know, he saw that, and yet as we get later in the book and he's talking about their use of spiritual gifts, we see again that they were kind of caught up with what they could do and who they were and how God had gifted them. So this pride thing is carrying over there. And so very quickly in this book, kind of like he does in Galatians, he gets right to the point. And I think I would have liked Paul. He gets right to the point. He doesn't play around. He just says what's on his mind. And so that's what he does here. And so he addresses very quickly the issue that was being manifest within the church that was reflecting this attitude, and that was that they were aligning themselves with different, what I would call, ministers or mentors. And so they were claiming, well, I'm of Paul. Well, I'm of Apollos. Well, I'm of Cephas. Well, I'm of Jesus. And we talked about what that was doing. And so Paul is showing that attitude is really contrary to the very gospel that they had received when they got saved. And so in verse 17, he reminds them, he says there, for Christ sent me not to baptize but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. And so he's telling them that they did not come to Christ based on persuasive arguments, based on intellectual presentation, based on oratory skills. They were won to Christ based on the simple truth of the gospel. He proclaimed them to be sinners. And he proclaimed them to have no way to remedy that issue other than to accept the person and work of Jesus Christ. And so as he dives into this issue, then that's really what we see in this chapter kind of being manifest. He begins to explain that what I'll call the economy of God, and I mean by that the way God does things, the economy of God is not the same as the economy of man. Totally opposite. And so that's really what we're going to see brought out as he goes into this. So let's read chapter 1, verses 18 through 31. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it's the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God, it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world, and the things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and the things which are not to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. But of him are ye in Christ Jesus, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. So the subtitle of this message, I would say, is that God's way is not man's way. And we would do well to remember that, and to remember that on a daily basis, because we tend to default and gravitate in most of what we do to what? Man's way. That's what's built into us. And it's not God's way. And so we need to get a grasp of that as we go through our day on a daily basis. And so he points out, first of all, that you know God's way to come to him was through the use of preaching. And he says there in verse 18, the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us that are saved, it's the power of God. Now, he's not really talking about the practice of preaching. He's not talking about what I'm up here attempting to do. He really, according to the Greek, is talking about the proclamation of the message, or the message proclaimed, the preaching of the cross. The message that's proclaimed about the cross is to those that perish foolishness. It's not so much as they sit back and say, look at that idiot up there speaking. He's preaching. That's a dumb thing to do. That's not what he's saying. But they are looking at the message proclaimed, the message of the gospel, and they're concluding, well, that's just foolishness. And so, you know, he talks here about two different groups and two different receptions. And he says the first group is them that perish. And again, some of your renderings would say, probably more appropriately, them that are perishing. It's a continual presence or continual tense of that verb. And so it speaks of them that are perishing, the acts that they are engaging in, the choices that they are making in their life are as people who reject the truth, and they reject it on a daily basis, on an ongoing basis throughout their life. And I think Paul is speaking of that same group in Romans 1. Ray took us there. And Romans 1:21, he says this, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. And we read there, it's somewhat of a process that people reject truth. And we're going to see this, we're going to pick this up again in a minute. They reject truth, and you might say, but what truth have they had? And we know the truth that they've had. The Bible is very clear. The heavens declare the glory of God. Paul said in Romans, they can understand that God exists and understand the power of His being by looking around at creation. There's not a person, even a blind person, can hear and understand that there is someone dramatically greater than them that brought all this to be. And then not only that, every person since Adam and Eve, when they ate of that fruit, what happened? What? Okay, but what else happened? Their conscience was quickened, wasn't it? They ate of a fruit and they were able to know right and wrong. And ever since then, every person that has entered this world understands there is basic right and basic wrong. And you go and you examine any culture in the world, and they have a sense, this is right, this is wrong. It may not be fully biblical, but they understand there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong. And if you ask them, I guarantee you, if they're honest, they will admit, no, I haven't gotten it all right. So Paul is saying over there in Romans, and he goes on in Romans 1, verses 19 and 20, he says, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So these people who make these choices, and they begin to make choices to reject God, to not have Him in their life, and then they begin to amplify their foolish decisions. And we're going to look at that in just a minute. But then there's another group of people, and it says, but unto us which are saved. Well, the wording is the same there. It literally means, unto us which are being saved, it's the power of God. Now, what is that all about? Is Paul teaching a works-based salvation? Well, we would all say absolutely not. He teaches in various places. We have been saved, we will be saved, and we are being saved. And what he's speaking of here is that we who have accepted Christ are being transformed. We are being changed. We are being converted from what we were to what we will be by the power of the gospel. It's the gospel that helps us understand, just as it did at salvation, that our human effort cannot bring about transformation in our life. So we didn't doubt that. When we came to Christ, we didn't doubt at all that I can't bring about my salvation. But we tend to get caught up in, maybe it's even subconscious thinking that, but I can have something to do with how I proceed from here. And Paul is basically saying, no. The power of the gospel is what transforms lives. We're going to look at that in a little bit more detail. We read in Philippians 2:13, consistent with this being transformed, for it is God that worketh in you both to will and to do of His good pleasure. So God is at work in the believer. He's at work changing our desires, and He's at work helping us execute the things that please Him. And then it goes on in Philippians 1:6, and he says, that which He hath begun, or He that hath begun a good work in you, will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. So there's no uncertainty here in Paul's words with regard to these people who are being saved. He's speaking of this gradual transformation, this change that occurs in our life. And so our salvation is certain, but there will be change. There should be change. There should be growth. There should be transformation in our lives, and it should come about through an understanding of the gospel. The gospel tells us that we're incapable of becoming what God desires. It's the gospel that tells us that we were without strength. It's the gospel that tells us that without Christ, we're helpless. And so why is it? Why is it, myself included, that we so quickly gravitate to, I've got this, I can handle this, I know how to do this, I know how to do that, rather than recognizing, as Christ said, without me, you can do how much?
Nothing.
How much?
Nothing.
Zilch. Nothing. And so that's what Paul is getting at here as he shares these initial thoughts about the preaching of the cross. But then he goes on and he makes a statement in verse 19, and he refers back to Isaiah 29:14, and it says, "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent." So Paul is alluding to a work of God that amplifies, if you will, the foolishness of man. Now that's going to sound really weird to you, but let me explain that. So there are multiple parts to this. If you go back to Romans 1, we see there it was the people that refused to believe. So that's the people refuse to believe God. They put Him out of their thoughts and out of their minds. But then over in 2 Corinthians 4:4, we read this, "Whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them." So there's another party at work in this unbelief. There are individuals who choose not to believe what has been shown to them. And then Satan is pouring fuel on the fire, so to speak, blinding the minds. But then, let's look back at Isaiah chapter 29 to get this passage in context. And again, I think what we're going to see here is a confirmation or another statement of the truths that we saw there in Romans 1. So in Isaiah 29, we'll start at verse 9 and read down to verse 16. So this is God through the prophet speaking to Israel at the time. "Stay yourselves and wonder. Cry ye out and cry. They are drunken, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord hath poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep, and hath closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. And the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned, saying, Read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, saying, Read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I am not learned. Wherefore the Lord said, For as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, that their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men, therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent shall be hid. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, Who seeth us, and who knoweth us? Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as potter's clay. For shall the work say to him that made it, He made me not? Or shall the thing frame say of him that framed him, He had no understanding?" So this quote, as it's characterized by most commentators, is the part taken from the last part of verse 14 there, "For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid." So what did we see in that passage? Okay, well, we read a verse where it says God was going to close their eyes and da-da-da-da-da. But we see clearly it was in response to unbelief on their part. It was in response to their rebelliousness and their stubbornness. So once again, we see three facets at work in this state of degeneration that we find in society. We find men and women who refuse to believe the revelation of God that's been made apparent to everybody. We see Satan fanning the flame, so to speak, blinding them. And we see God, as it is stated in Romans 1, giving them over to their sin, giving them over to their foolishness. So what do we see in our society? We see people that are supposed to be brilliant, and they come out with some of the dumbest ideas and statements that you can ever imagine. And they want us to believe it because they're brilliant. And they know all this stuff. And yet their conclusion is total foolishness. And that's what we see. That's what Paul's talking about here. He reinforces this analysis that he's making by what seems to be kind of a strange question in verse 20. He says, "Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?" Now, for me, as I first read that, you know, you tend to say, okay, he's saying all these people are just nothing. You know, they're no account. They don't matter. But let me ask you that same question and see what your answer would be. Where are the wise? Where are the scribes? That would be the people who are experts in the law. Where is the disputer of this world? Where are they in our society? Okay, are they not in our universities?
Yes.
Are they not in our schools? Present company accepted. Okay. Are they not in our governments? And are they not in our corporations? They are in essence the people that are leading the way with their foolishness. So Paul's not saying they've been relegated to obscurity. I think what he's doing, he's drawing attention to the fact that one day their world is going to be turned upside down. And so, where do we see that? Well, I've used this passage before. It's one of my favorite passages, and it probably speaks a little bit to my competitiveness. I like to be on the winning side. And that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing. But it's Psalm 2. And I just want us to read Psalm 2. And you know it. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed. There are those people. And since the beginning of history, they have been contriving an effort to throw His bands asunder. It goes on to say that. They say, "Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. We don't need God constraining us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then He shall speak unto them in His wrath, and vex them in His sore displeasure. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill." So we see this disrupting of their apple cart, so to speak, mentioned there. We see it again in Psalm 37, the first two verses. "Fret not thyself because of evildoers." Now, we look around and we see these things. And we do. We fret. It's easy to fret. We wring our hands. We can't believe where our world is going. But God says, "Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against their workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. That's where they're going to be. That's where they're going to end up. And Daniel 5, I think, is a perfect illustration of it. Dave took us there. You know the story of Belshazzar? And so he would have been one of those. He was, you know, royalty. He was powerful. He was rich. And here he's throwing his party. And he's taken the very vessels that had been taken from the temple that had been used in the worship of God, and he's holding them up, and he's worshiping his false gods. And God stepped in. And right there on the wall, you have been weighed in the balances. You have been found wanting. And your kingdom is no longer yours. That's what Paul is, I think, alluding to here as he raises this question after talking about this whole upside down perspective that man has. And then he goes to a panorama of history very quickly, and basically he says this approach, this thought process, this glorification of man's thinking just flat out doesn't work. It doesn't work. So he says, "For after the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God." So the world has had plenty of chances to, through their own practices, their own intellect, their own effort, come to know God. And not a single person has ever done it. It doesn't work. And that's what he's getting at here. "So it pleased God by the foolishness of preaching," or the foolishness of the message preached, "to those who consider it foolish, to save them that believe." To amplify the fact that it doesn't work, then he goes to two examples. He talks about the Jews. And he says, the Jews require a sign. Now, we know that from their history. As Christ was here walking the earth, you know, they kept saying, "Well, just show us. Prove it to us. Prove it to us." Well, he did time and time and time again. And they kept, no, you need to prove it to us. You need to show us something so we'll believe. If you just show us this, we'll believe. So that is the thought process of the Jewish nation refusing to believe, and the Greeks, which here is generally considered to mean the Gentiles, they seek after wisdom. They relish philosophy and science and all these higher types of learning, and that's where they think they will enrich themselves, enrich their souls, and ultimately take our society to a higher ground. And Paul is saying, it hasn't worked for how many thousand years have we been on this planet? It hasn't worked, and it's not going to work. But then he talks about what happens to those that believe. "But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." Now, in this case, those who are called, that word is used a few times in the New Testament, and it always implies those who responded to an invitation. So again, it speaks to the essence of the gospel. The gospel is an invitation to all to come. Those who are called in this context and with this word are those who have responded to that invitation. And to those who are of that group, whether Jews or Gentiles, Christ is the power of God working in their life and the wisdom of God working in their life. And then he goes on to say, in essence, that this thing they're getting caught up in contradicts their own history and their own experience. Look down in verse 26. He says, "For you see your calling, brethren, how not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. So here they were getting caught up with this thought process. Well, you know, he's really, really a brilliant man. That's who I want to align myself. It wasn't what he was teaching so much. It was more his characteristics. That's who I want to align myself with. And he says, well, but look at you. How many of you come from nobility? And how many of you were mighty before you came to Christ? And how many of you were wise before you came to Christ? And I think, you know, if we look around at our assembly, well, we would say, yeah, that's true. That's true. We're a pretty ordinary bunch. Come from pretty ordinary backgrounds. But God got a hold of our heart. And He is transforming us. Think, He is transforming us ordinary folks to be a power for Him. And so Paul is talking about that. And it reminds me a little bit when he goes through this description. I think, not me, I wouldn't have to be thankful for this, but I'm sure there are some people out there that are thankful that he used the word many, not many. He didn't say there are no wise men among you. He didn't say there are no noble, there are no mighty. And I think of Jesus' conversation with the rich young ruler. I think it was the rich young ruler. And you know, when he went away sad because he had great wealth, and Christ had told him to sell everything, and Christ said, yet it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And what did his disciples say? Well, who then can be saved? And he said, well, with God, all things are possible. And that's what I think Paul is alluding to here. Yes, there aren't many of these people that have achieved this recognition in the world that are willing to lay it down and give themselves to Christ. And yet that's what it takes. It requires us to lay it down. It requires us to give it up. It requires us to as Christ said, come as a child. And so again, my thought process, the thing that's just been burning with me is that we do that when we get saved. But then we seem to quickly put it aside and think that, you know, we're pretty special. Well, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And we go about life so frequently in our own power in many ways, not in every way, but in many ways, forgetting the truth of the gospel. That I cannot effectively go through a single day without being closely in fellowship and aligned with Him. So how can I get up and leave my house in the morning without spending time with Him? How can I do that? I'm forgetting the gospel when I do that. I'm forgetting my absolute dependence on Him when I do that. And so he would plead with us, I think, to don't forget the gospel in our everyday life. And so in verses 27 through 31, he again talks about the things that are God has chosen are the foolish things. What's he talking about there? Well, if you talk to most people that, well, maybe not most people you know, because most people you know are believers, but if you talk to most unbelievers that you know, and you start talking about the importance of humility and the importance of selflessness and the importance of really putting other people first, these things are foolishness to them. Oh, no, you can't do that. You can't go through life like that. You got to take care of yourself. If you don't look out for yourself, nobody will. And so that's the reaction we get when we attempt to live and share the truth of the gospel in our daily life. And he goes on through this, and I'm going to wrap up because this one verse just is so, so important. He says, he's chosen the base things of the world, and the things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, the things which are not to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. That no flesh should glory in his presence. Now, I want you to think for a minute. What do you feel pretty good about? We all have those things. What do you feel pretty good about? What do you kind of, you know, you don't do it, but in your closet you do that. In front of your mirror you do that. I'm pretty special. What is it in our lives that we feel that way about? This speaks to that. That no flesh should glory in his presence. All those things that we tend to get caught up with, when we stand before him one day, they're going to be nothing. Absolutely nothing. And there's not going to be anything that we can stand and say, hey, Lord, you remember when that was me. I did that. No. Because we can't do anything unless he's working in us and through us to do it. So that no flesh should glory in his presence. So there's so much here. So much that Paul was saying to them, so much that we need to absorb, that I need to absorb and lay hold of. And so many hard practices to break, to even recognize, oh, there I go again. There I go again. There I go again. That no flesh should glory in his presence.